Chapter 9. Ravitch returned to the hotel. Joan Madou had still been sleeping when he had left that morning. He had thought he would be back in an hour. It was now 3 hours later. "Hello, Doctor," someone said on the stairs. Ravitch looked at the man, a pale face, a bush of wild black hair, glasses. He did not recognize him. "Alvarez," the man said. "Jaime Alvarez, don't you remember?" Ravitch shook his head. The man bent down and pulled up his trouser leg. A long scar ran along his shinbone up to his knee. "Do you remember now?" "Did I operate on that?" The man nodded. "On a kitchen table behind the front, in a temporary field hospital before Aranjuez, a little white cottage in an almond grove. Do you remember now?" Suddenly Ravitch scented the heavy aroma of almond blossoms. He smelled it as if it had ascended the dark staircase, sweet, putrid, inextricably mixed with the sweeter and more putrid scent of blood. "Yes," he said. "I remember." The wounded had been lying on the moonlit terrace beside one another in rows. A few German and Italian planes had accomplished that. Children, women, peasants torn by bomb fragments. A child without a face. A pregnant woman torn open up to her breast. An old man who anxiously held the fingers torn off one hand in his other hand because he thought they could be sewed on. Over all that, the heavy night odour and the clear dew falling. "Is your leg quite all right again?" Ravitch asked. "Just about. I can't bend it completely." The man smiled. "But it was good enough to get me across the Pyrenees. Gonzalez is dead." Ravitch no longer knew who Gonzalez was, but now he recalled a young student who had assisted him. "Do you know what happened to Manolo?" "Imprisoned. Shot. And Serna, the brigade commander?" "Dead, before Madrid." The man smiled again. It was a rigid, automatic smile that came suddenly and was without emotion. "Mora and La Peña were taken prisoners. Shot." Ravitch no longer knew who Mora and La Peña were. He had left Spain after 6 months, when the front was broken and the field hospital disbanded. "Carnero, Horta, and Goldstein are in a concentration camp," Alvarez said, "in France. Blatsky, too, is safe, hidden across the frontier." Ravitch recalled only Goldstein. There had been too many faces at that time. "Do you live here in the hotel now?" he asked. "Yes, we moved in yesterday, over there." The man pointed at the rooms on the second floor. "We were kept in the camp down at the frontier for a long time. Finally, we were released. We still had some money." He smiled again. "Beds. Real beds. A good hotel. Even pictures of our leaders on the walls." "Yes," Ravitch said without irony. "It must be pleasant after all that over there." He said goodbye to Alvarez and went to his room. The room had been cleaned and was empty. Joan had gone. He looked around. She had not left anything behind. He had not expected her to. He rang. After a while, the maid came. "The lady left," she said, before he could ask her. "I see that myself. How did you know anyone was here?" "But Mr. Ravitch," the girl said, without adding anything, and with an expression as if her honour had been offended. "Did she have breakfast?" "No. I haven't seen her. Otherwise I would have thought of it. I know that from before." Ravitch looked at her. He did not like the concluding sentence. He pulled a few francs out of his pocket and put them into the girl's apron pocket. "All right," he said. "Do the same next time. Bring breakfast only when I explicitly tell you to do so. And don't come up to clean the room before you know for sure that it is empty." The girl smiled understandingly. "Very well, Mr. Ravitch." He looked after her uneasily. He knew what she thought. She believed Joan was married and did not want to be seen. In former days he would have laughed about it. Now he did not like it. But why not, he thought. He shrugged his shoulders and went to the window. Hotels were hotels. That could not be changed. He opened the window. A cloudy noon hung above the houses. Sparrows chirped in the eaves. On the floor below, two voices squabbled. That would be the Goldberg family. The man was 20 years older than his wife. a wholesale corn dealer from Breslau. His wife was having an affair with the refugee Wiesenhoff. She thought no one knew it. The only one who did not know it was Goldberg. Ravitch closed the window. He had operated on a gallbladder that morning, an anonymous gallbladder for Durand. He had cut open for Durand part of an unknown male belly, a fee of 200 francs. Afterwards he had gone to see Kate Hegstrom. She had a fever, too much fever. He had been with her for an hour. She had slept restlessly. It was nothing alarming, but it would have been better if there had been no fever. He stared through the window. The strange, empty feeling of afterwards. The bed that no longer had any meaning. The day that mercilessly tore yesterday into pieces like a jackal tearing the hide of an antelope. The woods of the night, miraculously grown in the dark, now endlessly remote again. Merely a fata morgana in the wasteland of hours. He turned around. On his table he found Lucienne Martinet's address. She had been released from the hospital a short time before. She had given them no peace until they released her. 2 days ago he had been with her. It was not necessary to look her up again, but he had nothing else to do and decided to go there. The house was in the Rue Clavel. Downstairs was a butcher's shop in which a strong woman was swinging a cleaver and selling meat. She was in mourning. Her husband had died 2 weeks before. Now the woman reigned in the shop with a helper. Ravitch saw her as he passed by. She was apparently about to go calling. She wore a hat with a long black crepe veil and was quickly chopping off a pig's leg to oblige an acquaintance. The veil waved above the open carcass. The cleaver glittered and came crashing down. "With one blow," the widow said in a satisfied tone, and flung the leg on the scale. Lucienne lived in a small room on the top floor. She was not alone. A fellow of about 25 slouched on a chair. He wore a bicyclist's cap and was smoking a homemade cigarette, which stuck to his upper lip when he talked. He remained sitting as Ravitch entered. Lucienne lay in bed. She was bewildered and blushed. "Doctor, I didn't know you would come today." She looked at the young man. "This is—" "Someone," the boy interrupted her gruffly. "It isn't necessary to toss names around." He leaned back. "So you are the doctor?" "How are you, Lucienne?" Ravitch asked, without taking any notice of him. "You're wise to stay in bed." "She could have been up long ago," the boy declared. "There's no longer anything wrong with her. When she doesn't work, it runs up expenses." Ravitch turned around and looked at him. "Leave us alone," he said. "What?" "Get out! Out of the room. I'm going to examine Lucienne." The boy burst out laughing. "You can do that just as well with me here. We aren't so fine. And why examine? You were here only the day before yesterday. That costs for an extra visit, eh?" "Brother," Ravitch said calmly, "you don't look as if you would pay it. Besides, whether it will cost anything is a different matter. And now get out." The boy grinned and sprawled his legs comfortably. He wore tapered patent leather shoes and violet socks.
"Please, Bobo," Lucienne said. "I'm sure it will only take a moment."
Bobo did not pay any attention to her. He stared at Ravitch. "It suits me fine that you're here," he said. "Now I can put you straight right away. My dear man, if you think perhaps you can bleed us for hospital bills, operations, and all that, nothing doing. We didn't ask to have her sent to the hospital, not to mention the operation, so it's no go with the money angle. You ought to be glad we don't ask for compensation for an unauthorized operation." He showed a row of stained teeth. "That's some surprise, isn't it?" "Yes, sir, Bobo knows his way around. He can't be easily gypped." The boy looked very much contented. He felt he had got out of that brilliantly. Lucienne became pale. She looked anxiously from Bobo to Ravitch. "You understand?" Bobo asked triumphantly. "Was he the one?" Ravitch asked Lucienne. She did not answer. "So that's it," he said, and studied Bobo. A tall, thin fellow with a rayon scarf around his skinny throat, in which the Adam's apple was moving up and down. Drooping shoulders, too long a nose, a degenerate chin, the picture-book conception of a suburb pimp. "So what's it?" Bobo asked, challenging. I think I've told you often enough now to get going. I want to examine her.
Merde,
Bobo replied. Slowly, Ravitch walked toward him. He had had enough of Bobo. The boy jumped up, stepped back, and suddenly had a thin rope of about 2 yards' length in his hands. Ravitch knew what he intended to do with it. When Ravitch came closer, he was going to jump aside, then get swiftly behind him and slip the rope over his head so that he could strangle him from behind. It would work if the other person did not know about it or attempted to box.
Bobo, Lucien called. Bobo, don't!
You young scum, Ravitch said. That miserable old rope trick, don't you know any better? He laughed. Bobo was nonplussed for a moment. His eyes became uncertain. In an instant, Ravitch had ripped his jacket down over his shoulders with both hands so that he could not lift his arms. "This is one you did not know, eh?" he said, quickly opened the door and shoved the surprised and helpless fellow roughly out of the room. "If that's the sort of thing you like, become a soldier, you would-be apache. But don't molest grown-up people." He locked the door from inside. "So, Lucien," he said, "now let's have a look at you." She trembled. "Calm, calm. It's over." He took the worn-out cotton quilt and put it on the chair. Then he rolled back the green blanket. "Pajamas? Why that? They're less comfortable. You should not move much yet, Lucien." She remained silent for a moment.
"I only put them on today," she said.
"Haven't you got any nightgowns? I can have two of them sent to you from the hospital."
"No, not because of that. I put them on because I knew—"
She looked at the door and whispered.
"That he would come. He said I was no longer sick. He wouldn't wait any longer."
"What? It's a pity I didn't know that before." Ravitch looked at the door angrily. "He'll wait." Lucien had the very white skin of anemic women. The veins lay blue under the thin epidermis. She was well-built, with delicate bones, slender but nowhere too bony. One of the innumerable girls, Ravitch thought, who make one wonder why nature puts on such a show of grace, since one knows what will become of almost all of them. Overworked drudges who soon lose their figures through wrong and unhealthy ways of life. "You will have to stay in bed pretty much for another week, Lucien. You may get up and walk around here, but be careful, don't lift anything, and don't climb any stairs for the next few days. Have you got someone to take care of you, besides this Bobo?"
"The landlady, but she too has started to grumble."
"Someone else?"
"No. Before there was Marie. She is dead."
Ravitch took stock of the room. It was poorly furnished and clean. A few fuchsias stood in the window. "And Bobo?" he said. "Well, he appeared again after everything was over." Lucien did not answer. "Why don't you throw him out?"
"He isn't so bad, Doctor. Only wild."
Ravitch looked at her. "Love," he thought. "That, too, is love. The old miracle. It not only casts a rainbow of dreams against the grey sky of facts, it also sheds romantic light upon a heap of dung. A miracle and a mad mockery." Suddenly he had the strange feeling of having become, in a remote way, an accomplice. "All right, Lucien," he said. "Don't worry about it. First become healthy." Relieved, she nodded.
"And that about the money?" she blurted out, embarrassed. "That isn't true. He only said so. I'll pay everything, everything, in installments. When will I be able to work again?"
"In about 2 weeks, if you're not foolish. And nothing with Bobo, absolutely nothing, Lucien. Otherwise you might die, you understand?"
"Yes,"
she replied without conviction. Ravitch covered her slender body with the blanket. When he looked up, he noticed that she was weeping.
"Couldn't it be sooner?" she said. "I can sit while I work. I must—"
"Perhaps. We'll see. It depends on how well you take care of yourself. You should tell me the name of the midwife who did the abortion, Lucien." He saw the defense in her eyes. "I won't go to the police," he said. "Certainly not. I'll only try to get the money back you paid her. Then you could be calmer. How much was it?"
300 francs. You'll never get it from her."
"One can try. What's her name and where does she live? You'll never need her again, Lucien. You can no longer have any children, and she can't do anything to you. The girl hesitated.
There, in the drawer, she said then. At your right, in the drawer.
This slip here?
Yes.
All right. I'll go there one of the next few days. Don't be afraid. Ravitch put on his coat. What's the matter? He asked. Why do you want to get up?
Bobo, you don't know him.
He smiled. I think I know worse than him. Stay right in bed. To judge by what I have seen, we need not be concerned. So long, Lucien. I'll drop in on you soon again. Ravitch turned the key and the latch simultaneously and quickly opened the door. No one stood in the corridor, nor had he expected it. He knew Bobo's type. Downstairs, the assistant was now standing in the butcher's shop, a man with a sallow face and without the ardour of the proprietress. He was chopping listlessly. Since his master's death, he had become noticeably more tired. His chances of marrying his master's wife were small. A brushmaker in the bistro opposite announced this in a loud voice, and also that she would drive him too into the grave before that happened. The assistant had already lost much weight, he said. But the widow had blossomed mightily. Ravitch drank a cassis and paid. He had expected to find Bobo in the bistro, but Bobo was not there. Joan Madou quickly left the Scheherazade. She opened the door of the taxi in which Ravitch was waiting.
Come, she said, let's get away from here. Let's go to your place.
Has something happened?
No, nothing. It's just that I've had enough of nightclub life.
Just a moment. Ravitch called to the woman who stood before the entrance selling flowers. Granny, he said, let me have all your roses. How much are they? But don't be exorbitant.
60 francs for you, because you gave me that prescription for my rheumatism.
Did it help?
No. How can it, as long as I have to stand in the wet at night?
You're the most sensible patient I ever met in my life. He took the roses. Here is my apology for having left you to wake up alone this morning, he said to Joan, and put the flowers on the floor of the taxi. Would you like to have a drink somewhere?
No. I'd like to go to your place. Put the flowers here on the seat, not on the floor.
They are all right down there. One should love flowers, but not make too much fuss about them. She turned her head quickly.
You mean one shouldn't spoil what one loves?
No. I only mean that one shouldn't dramatize beautiful things. Besides, at the moment it is better if there are no flowers between us. Joan looked at him doubtfully for a moment. Then her face brightened.
Do you know what I did today? I lived. Lived again. I breathed. Breathed again. I existed. Existed again. For the first time I had hands again, and eyes, and a mouth.
The driver maneuvered the taxi out from among the other cars in the small street. Then he started with a jerk. The jolt threw Joan toward Ravitch. He held her in his arms for a moment and felt her closeness. It was like a warm wind, as if she were melting away the crust of the day, the strange defensive coolness within him, while she sat there and spoke, carried away by her feelings and by herself.
The whole day, it threw itself over my neck and against my breast, as though to make me grow green and put out leaves and blossoms. It held me and held me and did not let me go. And now here I am, and you.
Ravitch looked at her. She sat leaning forward on the dirty leather seat, and her shoulders shone out of her black evening gown. She was open and outspoken and without shame. She said what she felt, and he found himself poor and dry in comparison. I was performing operations, he thought. I forgot you. I was with Lucienne. I was somewhere in the past, without you. Then, when the evening came, a certain warmth came slowly with it. I was not with you. I thought of Kate Hegstrom. Joan, he said, and put his hands on her hands, which she had rested on the seat. We can't go to my place now. I've got to go first to the hospital, only for a few minutes.
Have you got to look after the woman you operated on?
Not the one of this morning, someone else. Would you like to wait somewhere for me?
Must you go right away?
It would be better. I don't want to be called later.
I can wait for you. Have we enough time to go by your hotel?
Yes.
Let's go there first. Then you'll come later. I can wait for you.
All right. Ravitch gave the driver his address. He leaned back and felt the top of the seat against his neck. His hands were still on Joan's hands. He felt that she was waiting for him to say something, something about him and her, but he could not. She had already said too much. It was not so much, he thought. The cab stopped.
You go on, Joan said. I'll manage here all right. I'm not afraid. Just give me your key.
The key is in the hotel.
I'll have them give it to me. I've got to learn to do that.
She took the flowers from the floor.
With a man who leaves me while I sleep and comes again when I don't expect it, there are many things I'll have to learn. Let me start right away.
I'll come up with you. We won't overdo anything. It's bad enough to have to leave you alone again immediately.
She laughed. She looked very young.
Please wait a moment, Ravitch said to the driver. The man slowly closed one eye. Even longer.
Let me have the key, Joan said as they walked upstairs.
Why?
Let me have it.
She opened the door. Then she stopped.
Beautiful,
she said, into the dark room into which a bleak moon shone through the clouds outside the window. Beautiful? This hole?
Yes, beautiful. Everything is beautiful.
Maybe right now it's dark, but... Ravitch reached for the switch.
Don't. I'll do it myself. And now go. And don't wait till tomorrow noon to come back.
She stood in the doorway in the dark. The silver light from the window was behind her shoulders and her head. She was indistinct and exciting and mysterious. Her coat had slipped down. It lay at her feet like a heap of black foam. She leaned against the doorframe, and one of her arms caught a long shaft of light from the corridor.
Go and come again,
she said, and closed the door. Kate Hegstrom's fever had gone down.
Has she been awake? Ravitch asked the drowsy nurse.
Yes, at 11. She asked for you. I told her what you instructed me to say.
Did she say anything about the bandages?
Yes. I told her you had to make an incision, a light operation. You'd explain it to her tomorrow.
That was all?
Yes. She said everything was all right as long as you considered it right. I was to give you her regards if you came again tonight and tell you that she had confidence in you.
So... Ravitch stood a while and looked down at the nurse's parted black hair.
How old are you?
He asked. She raised her head in astonishment.
23.
23. And how long have you been nursing?
For the last 2.5 years. In January it was 2.5 years.
Do you like your profession? The nurse smiled all over her apple face.
I like it very much, she declared chatterily. Of course, some of the patients are trying, but most of them are nice. Madame Brissot gave me a beautiful, almost new silk dress as a present yesterday. And last week I got a pair of patent leather shoes from Madame Lerner, the one who later died at home.
She smiled again.
I hardly have to buy any clothing. I almost always get something. If I can't use it, I exchange it with a friend of mine who has a shop. That's why I'm well off. Madame Hegstrom, too, is always very generous. She gives me money. Last time it was 100 francs, for only 12 days. How long will she be here this time, doctor?
Longer. A few weeks. The nurse looked happy. Behind her clear, unlined forehead, she was calculating how much she would get. Ravitch bent over Kate Hegstrom once more. She was breathing quietly. The slight odour from the wound mingled with the dry perfume of her hair. Suddenly he could not stand it. She had confidence in him. Confidence. The flat, cut-up abdomen in which the beast was feeding, sewn up without the possibility of doing anything. Confidence. Good night, nurse, he said.
Good night, doctor.
The chubby nurse sat down in the chair in a corner of the room. She dimmed the light on the side toward the bed, wrapped her feet in a blanket, and reached for a magazine. It was one of those cheap magazines containing detective stories and movie pictures. She adjusted herself comfortably and began to read. Beside her, on a little table, she had put an opened box of chocolate wafers. Ravitch saw her take one without looking up. Sometimes one doesn't comprehend the simplest things, he thought, that in the same room one person should be lying deadly ill and the other not at all concerned about it. He closed the door. But isn't it the same with me? Am I not going from this room into another in which... The room was dark. The door to the bathroom was ajar. There was a light beyond it. Ravitch hesitated. He did not know whether Joan was still in the bathroom. Then he heard her breathing. He walked through the room to the bathroom. He did not say anything. He knew she was here and was not asleep, but she too said nothing. Suddenly the room was full of silence and expectancy and tension, like a vortex which silently called, an unknown abyss beyond thought from which rose the poppy clouds and the dizziness of a red tumult. He closed the door of the bathroom. In the clear light of the white bulbs everything was familiar and known to him again. He turned on the taps of the shower. It was the only shower in the hotel. Ravitch had paid for it himself and had had it installed. He knew that in his absence it was still being shown to the patron's French relatives and friends as a remarkable sight. The hot water ran down his skin. In the next room, Joan Madou was lying and waiting for him. Her skin was smooth. Her hair surged over the pillow like an impetuous wave, and her eyes shone lucidly even when the room was dark, as if they caught the meagre light of winter stars from outside the window and reflected it. She lay there, subtle and changeable and exciting, because there was nothing left of the woman whom one had known an hour ago. She was everything that enticement and temptation could give without love, and yet all of a sudden he felt something like an aversion to her, a strange resistance mixed with a violent and sudden attraction. He looked around involuntarily. If the bathroom had had a second exit, he thought it possible that he would have dressed and gone out to drink. He dried himself and hesitated for a while. Strange, what had fluttered in from nowhere, a shadow, a nothing. Perhaps it was because he had been with Kate Hegstrom, or because of what Joan had said in the taxi earlier. Much too quick and much too easy. Or simply because someone was waiting, instead of his waiting. He tightened his lips and opened the door. "Ravitch," Joan said out of the dark, "the Calvados is on the table by the window." He stood still. He realized that he had been tense. He could not have stood many things she might have said. This one was right. His tension eased into loose, light certainty. "Did you find the bottle?" he asked. "That was easy. It was standing right here, but I opened it. I discovered a corkscrew somewhere among your things. Give me another glass." He poured two glasses and brought one to her. "Here." It was good to feel the clear apple brandy. It was good that Joan had found the right word. She leaned her head back and drank. Her hair fell over her shoulders, and in this moment she seemed to be nothing but drinking. Ravitch had noticed this in her before. She gave herself completely to whatever she did. It occurred to him vaguely that therein lay not only fascination, but also danger. Such women were nothing but drinking when they drank, nothing but love when they loved, nothing but desperation when they were desperate, and nothing but forgetfulness when they forgot. Joan put down the glass and laughed suddenly. "Ravitch," she said, "I know what you are thinking."
"Really?"
"Yes. You felt already half married just now. So did I. To be abandoned at the door is not exactly an enviable experience, left alone with roses in one's arms. Thank God the Calvados was here. Don't be so careful with the bottle."
Ravitch refilled her glass. "You are a wonderful person," he said. "It's true. There, in the bathroom, I could hardly stand you. Now I find you wonderful. Salut."
"Salut."
He drank his Calvados. "It is the second night," he said, "the dangerous night. The charm of the unknown is gone, and the charm of familiarity has not yet come. We'll survive it." Joan put her glass down.
"You seem to know quite a lot about it."
"I know nothing at all. I just talk. One never knows anything. Everything is always different. Now, too. It never is the second night. It is always the first. The second would be the end."
Thank God. Otherwise, where would it lead? It is something like arithmetic.
And now come. I don't want to go to sleep yet. I want to drink with you. The stars stand naked up there in the cold. How easily one can freeze when one is alone, even when it is hot. Never when there are two.
Two together can actually freeze to death.
Not we.
Naturally not, Ravitch said, and in the dark she did not see the expression that crossed his face. Not we.